I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. African Americans have served in this country's military since the Revolutionary War. Today, we look at their participation in the Army's cavalry after the Civil War. Known as the Buffalo Soldiers, these men served with distinction. We'll hear from a local group that keeps their legacy alive. Then, an update from the agricultural front. We'll get a preview of what may be in store for the farm bill that's moving through Congress. And we find out the latest in the battle over the weed killer that's killing more than weeds. Brian McTavish will wrap things up with his weekend to-do list. In 1948, President Harry Truman signed an executive order prohibiting racial discrimination in the American military. That was a critical moment for recognizing civil rights at the nation's highest level, and it eventually led to the desegregation of American troops. But in this Black History Month, we're turning today to some African American military history that unfolded generations earlier in regiments that got their start at Fort Leavenworth and served throughout the American West. Joining us is John Bruce, he's the president, and George Pettigrew, the second vice president of a group here in the Metro that honors the history and legacy of what have come to be called the Buffalo Soldiers. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. So, John, let me start with you. Who were the Buffalo Soldiers?
They was all African American cavalry, black cavalrymen that served from 1867 through 1890, which was called the Indian Wars. They came in through the Civil War. After the Civil War, they brought them in July 28, 1866. Congress made provision, put six black regiments together.
And these regiments, one of them was based out of Fort Leavenworth.
Yes, the 10th.
And how did that come to be? I mean, where did the idea come from to say, let's put together some all African-American regiments?
Well, that came out of one of the commanding generals, Sheridan and Sherman. They, from Grant, to put Negro regiments together from their respective divisions. So the 9th and 10th was created at that time.
Now, George Pettigrew, these weren't the first African-Americans to serve in the military by any means. What was so significant about these soldiers?
The significance was this was the first time in U.S. history that African-Americans were included in a peacetime army.
Hmm.
They had served every war with distinction, I should mention. But after the war, just like most soldiers, they were sent back home because they had farms to take care of and they had duties and families. But realizing that the United States did not have a standing war after the reunification of the nation, then it was necessary for them to have a standing army basically to help open up the Western Territory to settlers.
So when we talk about these regiments opening up the West, where exactly did they go? George?
All over, yeah.
They went all over, you know. Even when the 10th Cavalry was created at Fort Leavenworth, they went west out to Fort Riley, Kansas. There, that's what basically got their name.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, how did they get the name? Why did they call them the Buffalo Soldiers?
It was a name that was given by the opposing warriors, the Native Americans. And we all understand and we all recognize that the buffalo was very sacred to the Native American. It was a way of life. It was life. And for them to bestow that name of the buffalo to a group of soldiers, I don't think in American history there's ever been another occasion where warriors on opposite sides would name one or the other with a name of honor. And that's what the Buffalo Soldiers is. It's a name of honor that was given by our opposing warriors.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the opposing warriors. I mean, some of the battles that the Buffalo Soldiers were engaged in were against Native Americans, which today, looking back with the lens of history, we would say they were displacing Native Americans from their land.
Right. Basically, were Native Americans, but they didn't always fight Native Americans. You know, they were responsible for building forts, Western Frontier. Their job wasn't just to fight the warriors. It's basically just protect the West. Even though the warriors didn't like the Buffalo Soldier, they respected them for who they were and what they were.
I mean, George, your great-grandfather was one of these soldiers, I understand.
Isaac Johnson.
What? Tell us about it.
Isaac Johnson was an illiterate slave. He only had one family member that he knew in the world, and that was his older sister. And one day, the first time he was ever off the plantation that he'd ever began to see the world, he was with his sister, and she was crying and quiet, and that's unusual. Mm-hmm. But he was small and excited. That evening, he returned back to the plantation without his sister, and what he didn't realize at the time was that he saw his sister sold at auction before him, but did not understand what it was he was looking at. Mm-hmm. Well, he was given as a gift to the daughter of the plantation owner, and with her, he moved to Montgomery, where she married, and there was a small hotel that he worked at that was family-owned. And he heard about the U.S. Army for the first time taking African-Americans in, and it certainly was no sure shot he would get in, but he tried. And he was successful because this was a coveted job at a time when the economy did not allow African-Americans to have jobs. There was no place in society or economy for them once they were no longer the tools of production. Then it turned out that he had to find his own way. Yeah. Well, this was a steady job, food, place to stay. And he was able to and accepted, and so he joined. And once he did, he came right through Kansas City in 1867 on his way to Fort Leavenworth with the 38th Infantry, which was also an all-black troop. He moved on through normally, went from slave to soldier in a matter of months, and found himself on top of a station. What do you call it? The old stagecoach. That's the word,
sure.
Stagecoach. And he was guarding mail, which was a function of the infantry at that time.
Yeah.
Took a bullet in battle at Cow Creek in Rice County, Kansas, not far from Dodge City. He was field bandaged, put back on his spot of duty, stayed on duty, and rode another 640, 650 miles with that wound to Fort Union, New Mexico, which was the nearest hospital. There was no turning back to go to Fort Leavenworth.
Wow. That's...
He had to stay on his assignment, and I can't take a paper cut. This guy could take a bullet wound
quite a story.
And ride for a month.
Yeah, you know, I understand that there was actually quite a diverse amount of kinds of jobs, kind of work that that these soldiers did.
Yes.
They had some early work in the national parks, sort of the
yes,
the
they were your, they actually were your first park rangers.
In fact, I see you're wearing a Buffalo Soldiers hat today, which looks astonishingly like a park ranger hat.
Well, you know, when they was in, Alex, that goes back to the Spanish American War, 1898. When they brought the 24th and 9th Cavalry back to the United States, served in California. They relieved all the white soldiers that were patrolling the parks out there in 1899. So when they came back, they redesigned as Stetson. And today we know it as a Montana Peak, a Montana Pinch, the Smokey the Bear hat.
Right.
The National Park Service adopted that hat in 1911. They adopted the Buffalo Soldiers as your first park rangers in 1916. Charles S. Young, a young Afro-American captain, was your first superintendent.
You know, one of the things I'm struck by to hear you talk about the valiant service of this group of soldiers in the late 1800s, here they were representing the United States, fighting battles out on the frontier, but they were fighting a very different battle on the home front. If they were to come back to their own homes, this is a time when African Americans would not have been honored as fully equal in any part of the country. What was that irony like, that here they are defending a country where they are being themselves oppressed?
It even goes further. If you realize that the 14th and 15th Amendment to the Constitution were not complete at that time, which meant that those soldiers in uniform on duty were not citizens and could not vote. Now, voting didn't matter a lot because there were no polls out in the West in Indian Territory. But the idea still is that these people gallantly served. And incidentally, there were about 24 Medal of Honors winners of the African-American soldiers during the Indian Wars. That was a feat that no one else, no other unit accomplished. That's an overwhelming number. And this is also at a time when there was no Purple Heart. So Medal of Honor was a real stretch. It's still the highest award they could receive. So these people that had gone from slave to soldier exceeded any other unit of the United States Army at that time.
And has there been reflection in the years since about some of those battles they did fight with Native Americans who themselves were facing an oppression of their own?
Well, you were having oppressed groups opposing one another.
Right.
And yes, that has always been a controversy. It was a controversy in the 1860s, in the 1890s, and still today with historians, it's a controversy. Why would you stand against? Well, there's something that lies behind every bit of service that every black man ever gave to this country, and that was we fight for our equality. We fight for our opportunity. We are not accepted, but if we prove ourselves, perhaps, and if you know this is the same perhaps that went through World War I, World War II, Korea, we always had that perhaps. If we go and we do well, we'll be accepted by our own nation. This didn't really happen that way. But nevertheless, it was a mission of every soldier that wore gold buttons on a blue blouse that he would fight his heart out and give his best and be heroic about it. But also, they had the lowest desertion rate, the lowest alcoholism, and they were the greatest able to achieve because the United States Army did something very unique. They put a chaplain with every unit. And this normally a chaplain was assigned to a post. The soldiers come and go. While you're there, you have a chaplain. When you're out, you're on your own. Chaplains moved with the unit. And they taught reading, writing, and arithmetic.
So it was
and
more
these
than just
guys
religious.
Would not miss a class, did not fail a test, unless they were out on patrol.
So I want to ask you both. You both are here in the jackets from this local group. I didn't give the full name earlier. It's the Buffalo Soldier Alexander Madison Chapter of Greater Kansas City. Your chapter is named for Alexander and Madison. Who were they, John?
Okay, James Madison, who was a World War II PFC. He served with the 10th Cavalry in North Africa, Italy, and European. Became the first president. And one day in 1966, him and Alexander were sitting together under the tree. They wanted to start a chapter. They started it first, but something happened. They had to pull it.
Yeah.
So they went here in 1966, 100 years later, after the creation of the all six regiments in 1866. So they started this chapter in 1966 to where it is today. James Madison and James Alexander, which James Madison's deceased, James Alexander's still around. So, after all, James Madison, like I said, was the first president, 52 years president. I am the second president. And this chapter's been living, we're about the first chapter in the National Association. They created this.
And what does the association do?
Okay, basically, the association brings all the chapters together. We got like 41 chapters all over the United States, even more in Germany. And every once a year, they have a reunion in different states. Last year, we hosted in Kansas City. Next year's in San Diego. So they get a chance to all the then, back then, that all the World War II Buffalo soldiers could come together and reminisce a little bit. But now, they do not.
If I may add about the creation of the Buffalo Soldiers, yes, John is only our second president in 52 years.
Hmm.
But even, I think, more ironic, or let's just say that to show the genesis of so many great things that have happened for African-Americans in Kansas City, we know that in the 18th and Vine area, of course, there was jazz, and we know that baseball started at the Y on Paseo. But it's little known that at the Armory at 19th and Highland was the building that the paperwork for the Buffalo Soldiers Association, which is the only recognized association by the United States Army. We're officially recognized by the United States Army. Started right in the 18th and Vine area. So between baseball, jazz, and Buffalo Soldiers,
yeah,
all had the same genesis in the same little two-block area.
So one of the ways that you all in your local chapter are preserving and honoring this legacy, what do you do? What kinds of events? How do people get to see you and hear this story?
Well, we're more oral historians than we are reenactors. I myself, John is a reenactor also, and also he's made 4 movies concerning the West. But for me, I'm not about laying in wet ground on a cold morning.
So, it's not for everyone.
No, it's not for me. And we're oral historians. Children are our main focus, but of course, our overall focus is everyone worldwide. It's a story that Bob Marley brought back up through his song. But here we continue to do the work of James Alexander and James Madison, our founders. And it is to let people know that we were here, that we are a part of American history, and that we played a vital role in American history. I mean, remember, we were the law and order of the Old West. It wasn't always as sheriff because every place didn't have one.
Yeah.
Rustlers, outlaws, bandits, just disputes between neighbors and citizens. They would call us in and say, please, return the property, settle the peace. And then let us go.
I want to make sure also, folks know about an event you have coming up. We're almost out of time, but there is a chance for people to see you next week.
Okay, you can see it. We'll be at the Center Middle School on February 21st and 22nd. We'll be there to educate the 6th and 8th graders and 7th graders. And also, before the time expires, there's 2 famous people that was Jackie Robinson, circuit lieutenant, was a Buffalo Soldier.
Yep.
Abner Doubleday, who invented baseball, was an officer, served with the troop.
Good connection with baseball. There's also another event coming up at the Mid-Continent Library's North Oak Branch. That's next Tuesday night, February 13th at 6:30. You can get more information at mymcpl.org. We need to take a break, but I want to thank both of our guests, John Bruce and George Pettigrew from the Buffalo Soldiers local Alexander Madison chapter of Greater Kansas City. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
When we come back, we will talk about what's going on in the world of agriculture, including an update on the big farm bill moving through Congress and the latest on that weed killer dicamba that has killed more than weeds. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we explored the long life of Laura Ingalls Wilder and what inspired her Little House series of children's books. You can catch that conversation and all of our previous shows at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, join us as award-winning writer George Saunders talks about his novel, Lincoln at the Bardot, which topped many must-read lists last year. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. Today, every few years, even in the most divided and uncivil of times, there's one issue, one piece of legislation that inevitably brings lawmakers together, rural and urban, Democrats and Republicans. It has to bring them together to pass, and it has a little something for everyone. That legislation is the Farm Bill, and it's now working its way through Congress. Here to educate us on how this particular sausage is made is Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media. She's joining us from Iowa Public Radio in Ames, where she's based, I think. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Brian.
Are you in Ames today?
I'm actually in Des Moines today.
Well, okay.
Well, I'm often in Ames.
We want to get that right. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
We should mention that in a few minutes we'll speak with another of Amy's Harvest colleagues about another egg issue, the problems with the weed killer gone wrong, dicamba. But first, Amy, it's been a few years since the last time Congress took up the Farm Bill. Remind us what it is.
The Farm Bill, which the current one was passed and became law almost exactly 4 years ago in 2014, is this massive piece of legislation that includes 12 different titles, actually, sections, and they range from different programs for commodity farmers, things having to do with conservation and livestock, crop insurance, but there's also the gigantic nutrition component, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, as well as other federally funded food programs. And the entire Forest Service is funded under forestry is also funded under the Farm Bill.
So I guess the question that naturally comes to mind is, why would all of those things be in one giant bill? They don't even seem like they have that much to do with each other.
Well, there's a few historical reasons and some logical reasons. I didn't mention rural development. There's a whole component of the Farm Bill that's focused on rural development. The history goes back to when the first farm bills were written in the early decades of the 20th century, and there was a recognition, this is sort of Dust Bowl, New Deal era, the recognition that farmers were now increasingly feeding people who didn't have access to land and were going to have to depend on food grown farther away. So if farmers went under, that would cause food problems for everybody. That was part of the reason. And then as the decades progressed and we got more into sort of the New Deal, the Great Society, the Johnson administration, and more recognition of the need to have things like safety nets for food consumers, for the purchase of food, that underscored this relationship between food producers and eaters, as well as rural and urban residents. And these days, one of the things that's often brought up is that representatives and senators from urban areas are interested in the Farm Bill because of its nutrition programs in particular and their poverty-fighting mechanisms, while rural lawmakers need urban lawmakers on board to support the kinds of programs that help farmers and rural development and the residents in their areas.
Well, in fact, you talked with a woman named Sally Worley about that. She's executive director of the Practical Farmers of Iowa, and who lives in the Des Moines suburbs. And here's some of the what she said to you about how the Farm Bill affects everybody.
The Farm Bill is the Food and Farm Bill, so it has all of the nutrition assistance programs in it. So it does impact a lot of urban people as well as rural. That's something that bridges that gap very well. However, as an urban resident, I think people should be aware of the Farm Bill and its intricacies. There are many, but just to see where the federal money is being spent and if that's something that they care about. For instance, is it all going to conservation? Is it all going to local food promotion, and see their satisfaction with where it's going and how that impacts the food that's landing on their plate.
That was Sally Worley talking with Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media. Amy, it sounds like we might better call this the food bill, food in every sense.
There are movements to rename it or to try to change the vernacular. I mean, the official legislation that is currently the law is called the Agricultural Act of 2014. Past laws have had names that included the word food, and some included jobs and rural. And so, yeah, it's a pretty comprehensive package, but I think changing the sort of shorthand Farm Bill phrase is not real likely.
You mentioned that the last time this Farm Bill was passed was 2014. Are the issues today pretty much the same ones Congress was dealing with then, or have there been significantly different or new things to consider?
One of the biggest differences for the atmosphere right now in these debates is that from 2012 to 2014, which was the period in which the current bill was being debated, farm incomes were doing quite well. In 2012 and 2013, farmers had high prices for several of their large commodity crops and very good crops. They produced a lot and got paid a lot, for them, speaking very generally. Right now, on the other hand, the agricultural economy is in quite a slump. And so the demands from constituents in the field are a little bit different for the representatives who are going to Washington with concerns. Also, in the last round, there was a huge overhaul of the farm safety net programs, and that's not likely this time. We're more likely to see tweaks to existing programs than the whole-scale rewriting of any of them.
You know, I'm wondering how this fits into sort of these broader discussions about the budget and spending and revenues. You know, we're living in a time when there's been a massive tax cut already that's passed. We've heard just today that the budget compromise Senate leaders have worked out increases spending on defense and on other domestic programs. The budget deficit already appears headed for a substantial increase. Does this create a political environment that is less friendly to the Farm Bill?
I'm on the one hand, I suppose you could say it's less friendly to everybody seeking appropriations.
Right.
One of the things that agriculture did overall as a broad sector on the last go around was to essentially impose its own budgetary limits. And so it really came in with a farm bill that many of its supporters said was lower than they might have asked for. You know, they tried to be quite conservative in that ask in the hopes that they'd get everything they wanted. And it's interesting because the previous Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, when he was on his way out the door as the administration changed, he was advocating to farm groups and some of the other groups involved in farm bill lobbying to not put a price tag on it, to figure out what they wanted and then what that would cost. But that seems to be advice that very few groups felt they could take. And right now there does seem to be another sense of everyone has to tighten their belts.
You know, one of the elements of this bill, as you mentioned, is SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. We generally call those food stamps. In a lot of other social service programs that are federally funded, things like Medicaid, we've seen a willingness on the part of the federal government to allow states to impose more restrictions, for example, allowing waivers that might require people to work in order to receive Medicaid. Do you see changes to the way SNAP is administered under the new Farm Bill?
There are some indications on the horizon and some changes that are already being discussed and possibly implemented in some states. Things that might, for example, change the requirements for adults without dependents and their eligibility. Again, there could possibly be some sort of change in the work requirements. There's always some discussion about whether there should be restrictions on how those dollars can be spent, and there's arguments on both sides of that. And so I do think we will see some of those discussions. It'll be curious to see how much those actually bubble up to a kind of general conversation versus being things that are very insular and kind of go away without much fanfare.
And I realize I'm asking you to predict the future about things that the crystal ball doesn't always work for. Let me ask one more question, though. What do we know about the timeline? When do we expect to see this this bill start getting closer to a vote?
This is another crystal ball question, Brian. People I've spoke with have said, despite rhetoric coming out of the House and Senate Ag Committees about their desire to get the bill done expeditiously, there's very little reason to think it will be in place before the current bill expires in September. The Farm Bill has a history of not getting done on time. The 2014 bill was to replace one that expired in 2012, and it took about 18 months after expiration.
Right.
So I think the bigger question is, how many times will the current programs have to be extended before a new law takes over? But, I mean, the current bill does expire at the end of September, and we'll have to see what happens.
We know that you will be there to tell us when that happens. That's Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media. She joined us from Des Moines and Iowa Public Radio this morning. Amy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So now we go from the Capitol to the courthouse. There are developments in the ongoing legal and financial questions around an herbicide that does wonders on weeds, but unfortunately has been doing wonders on crops in nearby fields as well. Joining us to unfold the latest in the saga is another colleague, Christopher Husted, and we begin with an excerpt from a story from Harvest Public Media where Chris gives us the background on a phrase and a word that are causing farmers a lot of headaches.
The phrase is pesticide drift. The word is dicamba. It's a type of pesticide. There's a lot of backstory here. And I think the easiest way for me to walk you through it is for me to do a little role-playing. Imagine I'm a farmer around the year 1900. I put my seeds in the ground and mostly pull weeds by hand. Not fun, lots of work, and unless I'm rich, I can't farm that many acres. Now, I should note that there are some farmers dabbling with chemicals extracted from plants, but not that many. In the background, however, scientists are working on the very long process of crossbreeding types of soybeans. Decades pass, and by 1946, I've got a few more varieties to choose from. And something else.
The tank is refilled in the field by mixing the special non-corrosive white powder with acetylene tetrachloride. These have been previously prepared in the...
All those chemicals meant for biowarfare during World War II? They double as quite effective synthetic pesticides for my soybean plants. Although it's not long before we find out just how unhealthy they are. Take it away, Joni Mitchell.
Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees.
Ah, the 70s.
Don't it always seem to go
that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. You pay for it.
Let's skip ahead again. The year is 1996. Yes, I'm still a farmer. Yes, I know this would make me more than 100 years old. Do me a favor, people. Suspend your disbelief for just a little bit longer. Because at this point, agriculture researchers at universities across the country have kept crossbreeding soybean plants. And by now, they're pretty good at it. I've got varieties that have been developed specifically for my soil and climate here in Missouri. But lately, everyone is talking about this new option, a miracle seed made by agribusiness company Monsanto. Their scientists have been playing around with the genes of soybean plants and found a way to make them immune to their new pesticide. So, you buy their patented seed, you buy their patented pesticide. You spray the new stuff, it kills every other plant, except for the soybean plants grown from Monsanto's new seeds. The name of this new miracle weed killer? Roundup.
It's dropping right to the floor. In fact, compared to the $70 a gallon Roundup cost in 1985,
and Roundup blew up for Monsanto. You can grow on more acres, you need less labor, and you get a bigger crop. That was tough to pass up. Of course, other companies got into the seed and pesticide game.
VT Double Pro Trait.
They're going to perform what the Roundup needs.
Some seeds were tolerant to one type of pesticide, but not to others. And this gets us to that very specific phrase I'm working up to, pesticide drift.
Just look at that line. Looks worse than usual.
Margot McMillan is walking around her organic vegetable farm in central Missouri. 3 years ago, pesticide drift from her neighbor's farm took out a chunk of her tomatoes.
Just with the labor and the plants, it was around $5,000. And if you looked at it as a retail situation, it was more around $25,000. This curling of the leaf is real characteristic. And then there's a real thinness to the, you can kind of see the thinness of that leaf. And they look like, to me, they look like little fists, like, help, help.
This is yet another knot in the tangled pesticide web. With more organic farms like McMillan's popping up next to conventional farms using popular pesticides, the problem just gets bigger. And if a pesticide touches her crop, poof, there goes the organic brand she needs to make money. This arms race with Mother Nature brings us to that very specific word all of this has been building up to, dicamba. It's a new ultra-powerful pesticide that's supposed to be able to kill all the weeds that have evolved to be immune to pesticides. And some states, like Arkansas, Missouri, and Minnesota, have put severe restrictions on dicamba's use. But some farmers say they have no choice. They need dicamba to keep up with superweeds created by other pesticides. And their budgets are so tight, they can't afford a bad crop.
That was Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted, who now joins us live from his home base at KBIA in Columbia. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, what ended up happening with dicamba? How bad is this pesticide drift that you talked about?
It's pretty bad. This is quite a historic year for agriculture in general, specifically soybeans. Across the country, 3.6 million acres are damaged because of dicamba, or I should say alleged, because their investigation is going into all of these. And particularly at home here in Missouri, we have 325,000 damaged acres. And that's a fairly substantial number for 1 year of growing.
How does the drift work? Is it blowing in the wind onto other crops? Is it in the soil? Or is it downstream?
It can do all of those things. Generally, drift is assumed to float in the wind from one farm, the intended target for the pesticide, and I should say pesticide here we're using as the umbrella term, specifically dicamba is an herbicide. So it can float on the wind to a neighboring farm, or there's something called volatility, where the chemical can actually volatilize, and which means it sort of kind of dissipates into a finer molecule and floats over to a neighboring farm where it lands on unintended target, which are soybean plants that aren't genetically modified to withstand that chemical.
Okay, so let's say I'm the farmer in that field with my soybeans, with your dicamba made by Monsanto upwind from me. Now, what do I do? What am I supposed to do about that when it's getting on my crops?
If it's getting on your crops, hopefully you have a really nice neighbor who has good crop insurance who will help you out and cover your loss if there's a substantial loss. If you don't have a nice neighbor, which is sometimes the case, you'll go to the Department of Agriculture and file a report. And hopefully within 2-3 years, because they are really strapped for resources, it will be investigated and you will find out if indeed it was dicamba and what restitution you have.
I suppose if you want to keep growing soybeans in the meantime, you've got to plant something. So what do you do?
This is the fascinating part of this, because it was so widespread. Everyone was unsure what was going to happen planting-wise for this 2018 season. There are a lot of people, farmers who I spoke with, who are buying dicamba-tolerant seeds, which they purchased last year, and they're just going to redo that again. There are certain farmers that are buying dicamba-tolerant seeds just to protect themselves.
Which they have to buy from Monsanto?
Monsanto has the Xtend soybeans, which are the more popular ones, but there's also dicamba that's put out by DuPont and BASF. So there's a few companies that have it, but Monsanto kind of has the corner in that.
So let me see if I am understanding this right. It's possible that this pesticide is causing damage, and one of the solutions for the people who are suffering from that damage is to buy more seed from the companies that made the pesticide.
Correct. And in fact, there's a lawsuit just filed in North Dakota, actually, an antitrust lawsuit alleging that farmers have to buy this company, Monsanto's chemical-resistant seeds to survive. Otherwise, they're going to have damage to their crops.
All right. So you mentioned this lawsuit in North Dakota. It's not the only lawsuit. There have been some developments just in the last week or two, I understand.
Right. There's 11 lawsuits filed in 4 different states. And that's Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, and Illinois. And Arkansas, Missouri, and Illinois are 3 of the hardest hit states. Kansas got, I think they're hit with about 100,000 acres of damage. But anyway, they've been aggregated to be heard in a St. Louis court, which instead of being heard in all the separate states, they are going to be focused to hear all those complaints, all those lawsuits in one location, which wasn't ideal for companies like Monsanto. But Monsanto did say that if you're going to choose one place to do it, please do it in St. Louis, which is obviously where their headquarters is. And those lawsuits allege that the herbicide has just caused significant damage to their properties.
And how has Monsanto, and along with the other companies, how have they been responding to all of this?
Monsanto's stance has been, this is not a volatility issue. This is not a bad chemical issue. This is more of a user error issue. So they're pushing to educate applicators of this chemical, have sessions, and also going back to, just training. They've also stood in defense of themselves, in a way, against states like Arkansas and Missouri, but specifically Arkansas, who has set a cutoff date for using this chemical this year, this coming season. They don't think that's necessary.
So what is next? I mean, we're waiting, obviously, for this case to work its way through the courts. What else are we watching for now?
So this season's going to be big just because they're actually anticipating more seeds, resistant seeds, are going to be sold. Monsanto anticipates that they're going to fill half the U.S. demand for soybeans. So that's 40 million acres of dicamba-tolerant seeds out there. A few states have set different limitations on when you can use them. So for Missouri, if you're in the boot heel, which is the most sensitive area to drift, you have a cutoff date of June 1st. Arkansas, which is much more sensitive, also has a cutoff date of April 16th. So we're going to see what happens with those. But in the end, at the end of this growing season, the EPA, which approved dicamba initially, will reevaluate the effectiveness and the safety of the chemical to decide if it will remain on the shelves or not.
Has the EPA indicated which way they're leaning?
Of course not. But they did set stricter limitations for this year. And the states I mentioned earlier, they're just adding on extra limitations because it's been so contentious across states that grow soybeans.
That's Christopher Husted. He's a reporter for Harvest Public Media, which is a reporting collaboration across the Midwest and based here at KCUR. He joined us from KBIA in Columbia. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Brian McTavish is here with your weekend to-do list. That's KCUR contributor Brian McTavish joining us. He follows and writes about pop culture and joins us in the studio each week with ideas for your weekend. Hello, Brian.
Are you ready to motivate?
That is very well spoken, sir.
Well, no more well spoken than Chuck Berry's guitar. At the beginning of Maybelline, maybe the greatest of all the great Chuck Berry car songs, he makes the guitar sound like a horn on a car,
yes,
right?
Yes, he's amazing.
He was amazing.
Well, yes, he's no longer as amazing.
Well, you know what is still amazing is World of Wheels. It's the 50. Oh, listen. Oh,
yeah.
He can go.
There it is.
There it is, and there it goes. And here we are. Woo! Oh, 58th annual custom car show, World of Wheels. It's been downtown since before, I think, both of us were born.
Yeah.
It will include appearances by World Wrestling Entertainment star AJ Styles, 6 to 8 Friday night. Dukes of Hazzard star, yeah, John Schneider,
yeah,
go ahead, break
that's
in.
That's the one that I really care about, the Dukes of Hazzard star.
Well, yes, yes. He's there. Well, here, no, take notes. 1 to 4 Saturday afternoon, John Schneider, Dukes of Hazzard, and this is his name, Horny Mike from Counts Customs. Well, what is that? Well, Horny Mike,
it's
said that twice,
said
didn't
twice.
I know, yeah. I'm in trouble now. He's an airbrush artist who puts 3D horns on everything he sees.
Of course he is.
And he works in Las Vegas, and it's Vegas, so what are you going to do? Anyway.
Are you into custom cars, Brad?
Well, I will be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Bartle Hall, but yeah, I'm into custom cars. I mean, I never had a custom car. I had a Pinto. Lots of things happened in
the
Pinto.
That's pretty custom.
I can't talk,
oh,
Will.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I
look at our time. We better move on.
Better go.
I thought I knew what I was hearing, and then I realized it's not what I thought it was.
Pass the ketchup and the mustard, too. It's Mac Sabbath.
Mac, with an M.
Uh-huh. It's a heavy metal parody band obsessed with drive-through fast food and Black Sabbath.
You know, Brian, what I think the world was really crying out for,
yeah,
was a heavy metal parody band obsessed with drive-through fast food and Black Sabbath.
I think you're right. I would say it was openly weeping at every turn.
Yes.
Seven.
And now I will be as well.
Here we go. Oh, you have to cut me off when it's time. I can't get enough of this. 7:30 Sunday night at Knucklehead's Saloon. Okay, so this sounds like Black Sabbath's Paranoid, but it's really the Mac Sabbath song Pair of Buns. They also do Frying Pan, a la Iron Man, and more ribs in the fashion of Sabbath's War Pigs. Just for the record, they're, again, fast food. They go crazy. They show up in crazy Ronald McDonald and, you know, crazy perverted Mayor McCheese outfits and McBurglar,
wow,
and Grimace outfits.
The mind runs wild.
Yeah, but
they're
not for it. They're against it. Even though they're sort of glorifying it in kind of a sick way, they think it's bad for you.
You should not be eating so much fast food.
I shouldn't be. How did you know?
Well, so it's not quite Weird Al Yankovic. It's they have a message.
They definitely have a message. They don't like genetically modified food. They're against overt consumerism, and they don't like the low wage, what they call McJob. Now, I go to McDonald's.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. But I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't go so much after listening to these guys. 7:30 Sunday, Knucklehead Saloon, Mac Sabbath.
And be sure to see Brian's 6 adult things to do in Kansas City this weekend. That's at kcur.org. Yeah. And speaking of adult things to do, Brian.
I'm ready. Are you ready for Burlesque Downtown Underground Addicted to Love? It's their 10th annual extravaganza inspired by Cupid and those arrows. Ooh, the sweet sting. 7 and 9:30 p.m. show Saturday night at the Musical Theater Heritage Theater at Crown Center.
At Crown Center. I didn't really think you could do burlesque at Crown Center.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I guess you can.
Apparently we can now.
Things like, well, maybe this is dating myself, but I do like myself, so that works out.
It's fine.
You can say things like va-va-voom.
It's Valentine's Day, after all.
It is indeed. Yeah. Or you can say hubba-hubba. You could say whatever the kids say now, as the members of Burlesque Downtown Underground enticingly strut to the theme of the mid-1980s Robert Palmer rocker we're now so enjoying about that habit of, you know, the oblivion of never-ending romantic obsession.
Is it? Can you be more specific? What exactly are you going to see if you go to this event?
You're going to see... It's not what you see, it's what you don't see that will make you go crazy. What do they call it here? I have a little something here that tells... Oh, yes, they call it high-performance tickle and tea. So it's what you don't see that will drive you crazy. What's the old phrase? Suffer, right?
Mm.
Right?
Is it? I, if you say so.
You've never been. Now is your chance. Now's your chance.
Suffer.
Saturday night, two shows, Musical Theater, Heritage Theater at Crown Center. Take most of it off, but please, not all of it.
Please.
Please.
The ship's sinking and the captain's asleep. I've been steady drinking since New Year's Eve. I got a whole lot of nothing, but it's all for me. Saving my pennies for the lottery. I'm a king bee, baby, don't take no job. And I go buzz, buzz all around your hive. And that's just because I was born to die. And it's with much love that I say goodbye.
What am I listening
to
now?
It's just slithering its way into wherever it slithers. That's Mickey Avalon. Let's just call it nihilistic rap, direct from super seedy Hollywood. 8 o'clock Saturday at the Riot Room. Special guest Dirt Nasty.
Yes, that would be a special guest.
Okay, so this is actually, this is entertainment for the masses, but he has lived a very hard life. He's a former heroin addict. His sister is seriously, very sad, died from a heroin overdose. He's had lots of tragedy. He finally got sober, or so he tells us, and I'm happy to believe him.
Sure.
So, you know, cut to not too many years ago, he's selling out clubs in California, he gets a record deal, and he starts rapping about what he knows best, street, drugs, and prostitution. This is his story. I'm just reading the sheet here. So here's an example of, they always say, hey, write about what you know. Rap about what you know. 8 o'clock Saturday. Ooh, rap. Ooh, strange. A little naughty Riot Room time.
If you say so.
I'm telling you.
All right. And what is making you crazy in our final pick for the weekend,
okay.
Brian?
It's not polite to kiss and tell. Would you agree, Brian?
For sure.
Okay, but in the animal kingdom, what do the animals care? So, kiss.
Is there a lot of kissing in the animal kingdom?
Well, there is going to be Saturday night at the Kansas City Zoo. It's called Kiss and Tail. Actors from the Living Room Theater will riff on love or something like it. I used to call it heat. Anyway, it's among the animals or actors pretending to be animals. There's live music. There's hors d'oeuvres. There's dessert. 6:30 to 9:30 Saturday.
The hors d'oeuvres are for the animals?
Well, you'll have to go.
I guess so. I mean,
or this, the animal in you, Brian, the animal in you.
This event is what weekends are for, Brian. Talking about animal love at the zoo on Saturday night.
Well, perhaps we should just leave it at that.
I think we probably should. Brian,
right.
Brian McTavish, KCUR contributor, always a pleasure.
Always.
If you missed any of our conversation today or yesterday's look at the life of Little House author Laura Ingalls Wilder, you can find all of our programs in podcast form at kcur.org/uptodate. Find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate, and I'm at PTSBrian. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Tomorrow, I'll talk with writer George Saunders about his award-winning book featuring our 16th president dealing with the death of his young son. It's a dive into the world of novels by Saunders. It's called Lincoln at the Bardo. Don't miss it. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.